gon' dock.
And this mess stinking.
When we ain't chillin' up in the bricks in the Shaolin, we chillin' out here in Montreal.
On CKUT.
Nobody do it better, dog.
90.3 FM.
Gone.
The following is a previously broadcast program. Directions on how to use your radio. Find the power button. Turn it to on. Turn the knob to CKUT 90.3 FM. Relax and enjoy.
Mosaic Show from the CKT Radio at 90.3 FM. I'm Sarah Hassanin. Today we're shedding some light on Egypt and we're looking into the economic situation there. According to a report by Al Jazeera, Egypt's pound has slid about 14.5% to a record low against the United States dollar after authorities announced a $3 billion international monetary fund deal with a commitment to a durably flexible exchange rate regime. The central bank also raised interest rates by 200 basis points in an out-of-cycle meeting, saying it aimed to anchor inflation expectations and contain demand-side pressures. In a statement on Thursday confirming a staff-level agreement on a $3 billion 46-month extended fund facility, the IMF said a flexible exchange rate regime should be a cornerstone policy for rebuilding and safeguarding Egypt's external resilience over the long term. It said the deal was expected to catalyze a large multi-year financing package, including about $5 billion in the fiscal year ending June 2023, reflecting broad international and regional support for Egypt. Egypt's central bank said it was intent on intensifying economic reforms and had moved to a durably flexible exchange rate regime, leaving the forces of supply and demand to determine the value of the Egyptian pound against other foreign currencies. And according to several sources, the pound weakened rapidly to around 23 to the US dollar from 19.67. The bank had already allowed the pound to depreciate by 14% against the dollar in March, and the currency had been slipping gradually since May. Former central bank governor Tariq Amir, under whom the pound had long been held steady, was abruptly replaced in August. Non-deliverable futures, which FX traders used to bet on moves in the currency over various time frames, pointed to the pound falling to around 24 per dollar over the next 3 months and 26 per dollar over the next year. Egypt's international government bonds also gave back the gains they had made earlier in the day, which had lifted the price of most of them by more than 2 cents on the dollar. A fuzzy haze of nostalgia is taking over me, which is why I'll air an interview I'd had with an Egyptian activist residing in Montreal 8 years after the Egyptian revolution. I will go 11 years back in time and reminisce about the revolution and its days and the time when we thought that democracy was possible, that things would get better. I had this interview with Mr. Mohammed Sharif Kamel. Mr. Kamel is a freelance writer. He's also a prominent Canada-based Egyptian political activist. He's a blogger, he's a professional engineer, and a member of several civil society organizations, and the co-founder and member of the Egyptian Coalition for Democracy. You're listening to The Mosaic Show from the CKT Radio at 90.3 FM. Of the world across different eras and changing times. Yet the cause is always universal: freedom, dignity, and social change. In the ever-evolving era of social media, when milestones come by the day, if not by the second, June the 8th, 2010, has secured a rightful place in history. That was the day Wael Ghanim, a 29-year-old Google marketing executive, was browsing Facebook in his home in Dubai and found a startling image, a photograph of a bloodied and disfigured face, its jaw broken, a young life taken away. That life, he soon learned, had belonged to Khalid Muhammad Said, a 28-year-old from Alexandria who had been beaten to death by the Egyptian police. At once angered and animated, Ghanim went online and created a Facebook page and named it We Are All Khalid Said. 2 minutes after he started his Facebook page, 300 people had joined it. 3 months later, that number had grown to more than 250,000. And what bubbled up online inevitably spilled onto the streets, starting with a series of silent stands that culminated in a massive and historic rally at Tahrir Square in downtown Cairo. The revolution in Egypt happened a few weeks after Tunisia's revolution, after which President Zine El Abidine was forced to step down and flee Tunisia. Soon after Egypt, the Arab Spring spread over other countries such as Libya, Bahrain, Yemen, and Syria.
The events in Egypt, which began on the 25th of January in 2011, came to an end on the 11th of February 2011, when President Mohamed Hosni Mubarak stepped down. Yet the domino effect has continued to be accompanied by serious unrest in the Middle East. After February the 11th, 2011, the Egyptian revolution took another turn. The security role was taken over by the military, and so was the political situation. The 2 years between 2011 and 2013 witnessed a political struggle for power among three poles: the 25th of January protesters and activists, the Islamists, and the military. But what added insult to injury was the fact that the revolution had yet to face what was known by the counter-revolution, led and supported by Mubarak's proponents. In 2012, Muslim Brotherhood Party members rose to power, and Dr. Mohamed Morsi was the first Muslim Brotherhood and democratically elected Egyptian president since the era of Muhammad Ali Pasha, an unprecedented democratic feat for the Egyptians. However, internal struggles for power persisted, leading to a military coup on the 30th of June in 2013, where Morsi was ousted within just 1 year of being elected. The military had incarcerated Morsi, and until this moment, Morsi has not been released yet. More about the causes, the outcomes, and phases of this great social movement after 8 years will be discussed today with my guest, Mr. Mohamed Kamel. Mr. Mohamed Kamel is a freelance writer, the editor of the For a Free Egypt blog. He's a professional engineer, a lead green associate, and a recognized project manager professional. He is a member of several civil society organizations, a co-founder, ex-secretary general of the Egyptian Revolutionary Council, and a co-founder of the Egyptian-Canadian Coalition for Democracy, among others. Hello, Mr. Kamel, and welcome to our show.
Hello, Sarah.
Pleasure to have you here today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure actually to speak to you and speak to our listener on the anniversary of the January 25.
Thank you. Okay, up front, why don't we start by going back to the causes? What triggered the 25th of January, in your opinion?
It's a long history. You mentioned in your introduction that Mohamed Morsi was the first democratic elected president of Egypt, and that's actually the main cause that Egypt didn't see real democracy most of its history. And it was actually corruption started to be to the bone on everything in Egypt, from economical, from development, no development at all, just corruption for the people surrounding the president and his family and his associated. And at the same time, there is no democracy. And you mentioned in the introduction, Khalid Said, Bilal Said came after on December, the attack on the church on Alexandria, and then the Tunisian uprising. The Tunisian uprising, actually, the inspiration of the revolution and the change came to the Egyptian just as a dynamo effect, a direct effect. They found that Tunisia was successfully in removing Zine El Abidine Ben Ali, was just another copy of Hosni Mubarak, one of the people who led those countries to the worst economical and political situation, human rights violation, and everything you can count on everything wrong. So it was actually a matter of time that the revolution come. And that's why January 25th, and I remember those days just prior to January 25th very clearly, when just a call to go out on the January 25th, which is considered the police day in Egypt, related to a very good political movement by the police against the occupation of Egypt on the 1952, so became the police day in Egypt. But actually the police violated everything on Egypt, so it became a day where a few Egyptian people decided to go out the street. No one ever imagined that this would be a revolution and that Mubarak will step down and everything will change. And if you remember correctly, the call for out for demonstration against police brutality and with call out for resignation of the Minister of Interior, who's responsible for the police. So that was a maximum that people can think of. But the arrogant government in Egypt at that time, the way they acted, the way they reacted to the way that people have the right to go out the street, have the right to demand, make the people really more inspired for more. They looking for more until the call came out that this regime has to collapse, has to fall. We don't need this regime anymore, which is a call known in Arabic as Shabi Yurid Iskat al-Nizam, and became a famous call in the old Arabic country caller, which is this regime has to go. So started by Mubarak Day. And actually, it is a moment that is not, it never came twice to a history of a people. So that's what all led and how it's developed, almost in a summary for sure. It's more than this.
Yeah. Going back again, I know that you've been living in Canada for a while. So where were you when it all happened? Like, were you here in Canada? Were you in Egypt?
I was in Canada. I was in Montreal. In Canada, actually, starting 2006, we started to have a small movement from Egyptians who really look forward to have a better Egypt for their relatives, for their friends, for their sons and daughters over there. So we started a small movement for democracy in Canada. It was in Montreal, actually, started. And we started to communicate with the Egyptian consulate here and the Egyptian embassy, sending letter to Mubarak directly with, I remember, it was about 10 or 11 demand that's actually cover what people came out in the street looking for bread, freedom, and dignity and social justice. We started with a movement, the judge movement. It was a juridical movement in Egypt against the regime, the brutality of the police, and the corruption over there. There was a movement of the labor on El Mahalla, is known, April 6 after. Many movement came. So when people called for a walk out in the street on the January 25th, we found that Montreal has to be in support of them. And we know and people live under those fascist regime. Actually, I just call it fascist regime. They're usually looking for their relative and friends and supporter out of Egypt who can speak freely about them. So we organized a small movement here at the time. We said that, our slogan was very clear. We went in front of Mil de la Gouchetière, which is at that time was an Egyptian consulate in Montreal. Many went around in Canada as well, but I can concentrate in Montreal, where I was at the time. We went out and we said, as long as people out in the street in Egypt, we will remain out here. Actually, I remember it was minus 25 to minus 30. For sure, we did not just sit there for the 18 days, but we were actually, because we have our life to live here, and it's actually different than what people left it in Egypt. But every single day, we went out 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. in front of Mil de la Gouchetière, saying the same thing Egyptians saying in Egypt. Exactly. We were their sound. At that time, in Egypt, it would be midnight over there, and then we sound and we recap everything happened on the day over there. This has really opened a very good opportunity for the movement in Egypt to be heard by Canadians, because media just picked up what's going on. And I remember that about three, four of us were really just running between the studio of CBC, RDE, everywhere you can find media was there in front of the consulate as well. And we're covering day by day, exactly what's going on in Egypt.
Canadian people and their take on what was happening in Egypt and how the Canadian media portrayed the Arab Spring. So you were mentioning that CBC was covering the events on a daily basis.
Every single media, and actually I can say everyone in Quebec, in Canada at large, they were covering this. It was the top of the news. Egypt, not a small country. Egypt is a big country in the Middle East. for sure. Canadians, in normal way, they don't care about the Middle East because it is not really, they are far, you know. And the only thing they know about the Middle East is Palestinian struggle for freedom. So it, there was a movement here in Quebec, came up with the Tunisian revolution. And actually, we were with the Tunisian people when they went out for the struggle before even we know that Egypt might rise up. And at that time, so we started, the media started to speak about, they call it at that time the Arab Spring, and they start to speak about what's going on in the Middle East. And then it started to open to the mainstream beside the civil society and the NGOs in Quebec and Canada that there is something going on in the Middle East and there is injustice going on there. So I think we as a civil society have to stand out for this. So at this moment, really the sound of change in the Middle East came across to Canadian. And its media and even printed media and social media started to really spread what's going on in Egypt after what's happened in Tunisia.
Okay, when you heard, you first heard that something happened in Egypt, was it on the 25th or later on the 28th, on the Friday of Anger?
No, the first we heard was the 22nd, when the call out for the 25th started the call out came before 22nd, but the 22nd started to be more known, at least for the people who are following the situation in Egypt. So that's where the first we heard about. And actually on the 25th, we were in front of the consulate, exactly as the people were in Egypt, different time zone for sure, but we were in front of consulate. We'd never imagine that it will continue. We just say it's a day of anger, and we have to be part of those people. We are angry at those people as well. We're supporting them. So we said, okay, let's go out. Let's be there representing our people in Egypt, our friends and family. So we did. And actually, 25-28, we start saying on the 25th after our vigil in front of the consulate, we said, okay, look like in Egypt they continue. Because people stayed on the street on 25 the night. People didn't go home at the day. The 25th didn't became just the 10,000-15,000 people on the street. No, we start speaking about hundreds of thousands. So in this case, we said, no, yes, we go home now. We come tomorrow, the day after. We stand there, and then we'll follow what's going on in Egypt. So that's how it's continuing with us from beginning, before even the 25th.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. We're gonna rise up and get their share.
Talking about it.
back once again. You're listening to The Mosaic Show from the CKT Radio at 90.3 FM. I'm Sarah Hassanin, and we've been talking to Mr. Mohammed Sharif Kamel, a prominent Canadian-Egyptian political activist. And today's interview is about the Arab Spring Revolution in Egypt.
And, okay, when you started to sense that this was becoming big and people were not going to go back home and it was not just a day, but it was going to take longer, when you sensed that, how did you react? How did you feel?
It's actually, it was the 28th that really where everybody in Egypt and outside start to recognize that there's something really.
The angry Friday.
The angry Friday. And people start to feel that there's something wrong going there, and we have to continue to maybe we can gain something, we can stop this. And the killing of people in the street, that's actually it was the first time in Egypt history that this happened. Egypt lived under dictatorship for hundreds of years, but that the first time that police can go in the street and snipers on the top of buildings and start shooting on people directly, and police cars, police trucks start to just crash people in the street. It never happened before in Egypt history. So I think people in Egypt, and we were actually the mirror of what's going on the street, people in Egypt started to feel that it is a time now that we have to reject all this, because there is no return here. There is no return when you find that you're going on the demonstration. The worst was using the gas bombs or whatever, the tear gas or stuff like this. But live ammunition and snipers, that's where the people in Egypt said, no, we can't stop here. And we were really the mirror of what's going in Egypt. So we said, okay. And that's where, as I mentioned earlier, that's what we said. As long as they are in Tahrir, we would be in Tahrir. We could call it Mildar Bushitir, we call it our Tahrir. So we could call it as this one. As long as people are there, we are there. We were not going to go home before those people really go home or get what they want.
You were vicariously living the experience, though you were very far here in Canada, but you sort of identified with the people. Your feelings were resonating with what was going on. Now, the 18 days that lasted from January the 25th until in the year 2011 to February the 11th, 2011, were full of good and bad times, ups and downs. Many people died. Ugly confrontations took place. That was the struggle for freedom. Yet, let's also remember that those were the best, the golden days Egyptian history can ever witness. How can you elaborate?
Oh, for sure. In the unity of people, the people on the street did not ask who is standing beside me or behind me, because we are all in the street just going for the same cause, the same goal. We have the same destiny. We are all the Egyptian. We are all the people suffering under this regime. So it never asked the question. And the mirror was here in Montreal. People were in front of the consulate, don't know each other. Just they are Egyptian and non-Egyptian. Arab, there were there many Arabs people. There is many, I can say, Quebecer. Quebecer joined us as well. So people start to feel that there is a solidarity movement really being built among Egyptian on the Tahrir Square and all Egyptian squares. It was Tahrir token as a symbol because it was Alexandria, it was Luxor, Aswan, Suez. It was the biggest in Suez city. So it was really this is what really considered the very bright thing of this revolution, that people understand how they can come together, how they can be in solidarity together, how they don't ask ideology or identity or religion identity or anything. We are all Egyptian. We are all suffering from this. So this is the really bright thing of this revolution. There is no revolution without casualty, unfortunately. That's for sure, you know. So yes, people died. Yes, people been killed, but it's a price. It's an unfortunate price, but it has to be paid so we can carry with our aspiration as Egyptian and reach our goal. So people standing beside each other, this is really the strongest message to all regime, not only in Egypt, out of Egypt as well, that all regime or dictatorship, that when people stand beside each other, they can achieve something.
I would like to elaborate more on the values. What Egyptian values has the 25th of January revealed that even many Egyptians haven't been aware of before?
On the years before that, the regime tried to break Egyptian identity into just actually nonsense issue of just people are careless, people just try to make meet end and just try to live their life. They don't care about politics. And really, Egyptian was not really involved in politics, because especially the two election, parliamentary election, called the election in Egypt before this, which is one of them, the reason of the 2011, which is the 2010 election, I think it was October, November, the election, it was actually false election, very clear what's going on. And that's what they try to build in people, a mentality that you are not capable of doing anything. We are the government, we are the regime, we'll do whatever we like, whenever we like, you just have to follow us. So Egyptian went to a moment that they do not defend their rights. Yes, there was demonstration here and there. We spoke about the 2-6. We speak about judges' movement. We speak about the labor movement. Yes, there was something here and there, but it was not really under what happened on January 25th. So that's what January 25th brought up, that Egyptian, if they would like to achieve something, they will. And I would like to generalize it. It's not only Egyptian. It's every people. Every people, when people will really come on the front and face the dictators, they will achieve something. And that's what Egyptian, actually, the best thing came out of them. The other things, we knew the stories, and we didn't live it personally, but for sure I heard it from firsthand. People who was in Tahrir Square. When I went to Egypt after the success of the revolution, and when they came to Canada as well, and in social media, that's how people was in solidarity together. There is no theft happened on Tahrir or the square where people struggled. And this is something not normal in having all this mass of hundreds of thousands of people everywhere on the street for many days, and there is no theft. People were very generous distributing food and drink to each other. They don't ask you, what did you order this? No. You were there. You were one of us. You were eating with us because we have to eat. We have to drink. Stores, restaurant was bringing foods out to the people on the street, bringing water out to the people on the street and drinks. So this is generosity. And really the security that Egyptian lived on this revolution, Egypt never see. Egypt didn't see today. We'll jump to today later on in our discussion for sure. But Egypt don't see the security that people were very safe,
yes,
and secure while they're outside, targeted by the police, killing them, shooting them, sniper on the top of the buildings. But people in the square feel secure, feel really comfortable. That's actually something it's not easy to achieve on those hundreds of thousands of people all around the place. They don't know each other, but they respect each other. We know that actually there is sexual harassment in Egypt, and everybody spoke about this. On those days, there is none. That girls,
no sexual
ladies,
harassment
at all. There was none on the square of those. There's none known or reported or even unreported. There's none. But while this issue, unfortunately, is known that in Cairo Street, as per we know, is the most unsafe place for women to go on the street. But in those days, women were safe. Beside men, they don't know. And that was really the real value of Egyptian, how they care about each other, how they respect each other, how they don't ask about each other if you are with us or against us. No. You are Egyptian here to achieve your goal.
Yeah. So they huddled up together, and that's how they secured each other. It was really amazing. As you mentioned earlier, the last days of Mubarak's reign, there were lots of church bombings.
Yeah.
And let's go back to those 18 days and try to see, were the churches safe? Any bombs?
Every place in Egypt was safe, because there was no way that this could happen in Egypt. And we remember and we know what what happened on the Christmas Eve in Alexandria, on the church, where there's this bomb in front of the church. And he's being accused as Islamist to start to do that. And that's known in the Egyptian regime, do that usually. They just bomb a church, and they don't care about people's life. And then the Islamists did that. And then we knew after the revolution, when the real investigation took place, that the police who did this. And that's
They planned the whole conspiracy.
And that's what police do in Egypt until today. And in those 18 days, police would have no time to do that because they were busy killing people in the street. So
Trying to protect the regime.
So they don't
The ailing regime.
So they can't have time to just bomb a church. So no, we have other things to take care of. So that's why in this period, there is nothing like this happened at all. And Christian and Muslim was there beside each other. Christian was protecting Muslim when they do their prayers. There's no problem at all. Because I left Egypt, and I lived in Egypt, and I have a lot of Christian friends, and I'm Muslim, practicing my Islam, but a lot of friends are Christian in Egypt, and we lived together all our life. We never have a problem. We never have a problem, but those incidents that's been fabricated by the regime, and the regime actually use some of fanatic and try to turn them against each other, and that's unfortunate dictator usually do.
So let's say that over those 30 years they've been feeding sectarian violence.
Oh, that's for sure, and we saw it. And actually, it's more than 30 years. At the start, we know on the 76, what do you know, that Zawiya al-Hamra, it's a district in
Cairo.
It was
an incident, yeah.
An incident over there, which is the first incident to find that Muslim and Christian fighting because of nonsense. It drove in later.
Somebody who spilled water or
exactly,
something.
Exactly, spilled water on the balcony of the other person. So that's what would be this. But it was a huge thing, and then it started to spread.
Now we're going to get to the hard part. Any revolution has its own mistakes and its inevitable phases of success and failure. Like if we take a look at Russia, France, Chile. So in your view, what were the Egyptian revolution's mistakes?
The biggest mistake of the Egyptian revolution, that they left the square when Mubarak resigned or forced to resign or whatever happened. That's because we don't know what happened between the army and Mubarak at that time, but at the end, he resigned. So at this moment, Egyptians found that, okay, we achieved it, which is not correct at all. We did not achieve it at this moment. We just cut the head of the regime, but the regime is deep infiltrated on the society over there. So at this moment, Egyptians shouldn't go back home and should stay.
They should have stayed
until they achieve what they want. That's number one mistake. Number two mistake is competition started early between what we can call them Islamists and what we call them liberal in Egypt. And actually, they started to compete together in a very strange way, and not understood at all. Because they start to just, okay, we did it, let's cultivate what we gain. No, you did not gain anything yet. You just removed Mubarak, which is a big achievement. I'm not saying it's a small thing, but it is not the real things that we should stop at. Actually, it should not stop at all, but it's phases. In this phase, people should not go back home and say it's over. It's done. Let's the army settle the things. And unfortunately, Egyptians had trusted their army for a long time, and I'm one of the people who trusted the army before what happened on 2013, and before what happened on Mohammed Mahmoud, before what happened on Tahrir Square.
The civil unrest
that happened after the revolution. We trusted the army because we knew that the Egyptian army was a component of Egyptian people. It was not an elite.
Yes.
And then we discover later on that the elite has been built within the army, and the special interest for the benefits for every one of those leaders in the Egyptian army make the army completely different than what the Egyptian people knew before. So that was the second mistake, is a competition and trusting army. So those things actually didn't play well. But as you said earlier, there is no revolution get out the result from the first round. Mm-hmm. And that was the first round.
Okay. So let's say that when self-interest surfaced, that's when the revolution started to lose on the ground.
That's for sure.
I'm glad that you mentioned 2013, because maybe until today, Egyptians are separate as to whether what happened on the 30th of June 2013 was a coup d'etat or a revolution. So if we take a look at coup d'etats generally, or where the military sometimes intervenes to take over, in Africa, 23 countries have seen at least three coups, and in 12 of 40 African countries, coups occurred within 5 years of gaining independence. My question here is simply, why Africa? Why is this common in Africa?
Yeah, let's put it in a different way. That's Africa was all of it under occupation from the Western power almost until early 40s, 50s. After the Second World War that the occupation and those big emperors start to collapse. The British, the France, they start to get tired and it was costly that they occupied the lands. So they decided to withdraw, or under people pressure for sure as well. It's not only their wealth, because that's why it's more expensive for them, for life and the investment over there. So they decided to withdraw, but they left behind their agents. And their agents are different countries, different situation. Some agents work on economical. The mining in Africa, we know what the mining industry in Africa, and ore mineral, ore material stuff in Africa coming as a really real resource for industry in Europe and in North America as well, and in the army as well. When they are actually end by withdrawing those occupation forces from over there, and people in Africa start to felt their really freedom of choice and freedom of life very clearly. The choice was not directly jumping to democracy as we know here in the West, because democracy as we know in the West it has to go through a process of, let me call it, training. And it's self-training. Nobody will train anybody. It's just self-training to develop democracy, because we don't forget that Africa has a lot of tribe as well, and the tribes are usually have the same thing as we spoke about Muslim and Christian in Egypt. On early Egyptian history, on the 100 years ago, exactly, there was a revolution in Egypt in 1919, and this revolution was actually to try to stop the sectarian violence that created by British when they occupied Egypt, and they tried to, which is divide and conquer. They tried to divide Egyptian into Christian and Muslim against each other. And the same thing happened between the tribes in Africa. So all this and the resources and all this stuff make the African is in their first step for freedom and building their own destiny by themselves, still shadowed by the occupation, still shadowed by created corruption within the society. So that's why in the beginning, some of the countries was able to move to democracy, very few, not many, and the others have to go through a coup d'etat, which is one time the coup d'etat would be the people will, the people really don't need this corruption and need to remove the government, so they have no power but to go to the army because there is no democratic process.
That's the only resort.
That's the only resort. And the other side might be the counter freedom and counter revolution and pro corruption, use the army as well to have a coup d'etat. So that's why we have several coups in Africa. It's actually not Africa only, because if you go to Latin America, you will find mostly the same. It's different for sure, different culture, different history and the way it's been built. If you go to South Asia as well, there's several as well over there.
Okay.
But Africa was actually very clear, because the occupation actually start to move from Africa almost at the same time. That was the 50s, after the
independence
start to gain at this time. Mm-hmm. So that's why we have a several coup d'etat in Africa.
I wanted just to go back briefly to the part where the prisons were opened and many prisoners were released. There have been allegations as to who did that, and it's still not clear. But What did the people do? Like, how did they react back then? And what does this show us about the role of the Islamists as a contribution to the revolution?
For sure, the regime tried in the beginning, and we have to divide the Islamists into several sects, because it's not just the baggage that has all people have an Islamist ideology and that's the difference between Muslims, Islamist in political term. So those people have the Muslim Brotherhood, and then have the Salafist movements as well. So those are separate. They're not the same thing as all. And we know that the government, on the 27th, of January, went and arrested all people that they listed under the government record, on the police record there, and they arrested them. And for sure, at this time, most of them was from the Islamist movement. And they've been arrested. The issue of open the prison was known then and now, because you cannot open the prison by yourself. Prisons are very secure, and they've been opened just to create the chaos on the street. Part of them as using the thugs on the Egypt to create the chaos. And we remember
They kept looting here and there.
Yeah, exactly. The camel battle, which part of it, that's having just thugs on the street try to kill.
Let out their camels on the people.
And that's why people were afraid and would run away. And that's when have an interfight. And that's when interfight, so the police come and then stop it. Which is, thanks God, it never happened. It just stopped at there. So the open the prison was the same thing. It was organized by the police forces, but by the state. And we know that one of the head of the prison refused to open the prison, and they shot him at the moment on front of, at his office, at his desk. And that's, I think, Wadi Nutron prison, if I remember correct. I'm not sure of the name.
Yes, I guess, yes.
I think so.
It was one of the oases of Egypt.
Exactly. And then it's known that this person been shot by the police forces, by the secret police forces, because he refused to open the prison. So this being opened to create a chaos.
And that was a part of my interview with Egyptian-Canadian blogger and political activist, Mr. Mohammed Sharif Kamel. I'll leave you now with some Middle Eastern songs and hits. And at the end of our show, I'd like to thank the CKT family and the Mosaic crew, Pranjal Malik, Kareem Araji, Yahya Sadiq, and Jack Solar. You've been listening to The Mosaic Show from the CKT Radio at 90.3 FM. I'm Sarah Hassanin. Thank you for listening.
ماشية السنين والناس ركاب معاك. Thank you. CKUT is looking for a full-time sales and administrative coordinator. The sales and administrative coordinator is responsible for the sale of on-air advertisements and co-presentation partnerships, as well as the negotiating of the radio station's administrative contractual agreements. The ideal candidate will have a passion for community radio, the ability to work with volunteers, clients, and community members, is well-organized, and has strong negotiating skills. We are looking for someone with knowledge of Montreal's arts, culture, and activity scenes who sees media as a tool for building community and can work in a non-hierarchical organization. Financial literacy, bilingualism, and experience with Google Suite products are also a requirement. For full details about the position, wage, and benefits, please visit ckut.ca. The cutoff for applications is Monday, February 6th at 5 p.m. CKUT strives to be a progressive working environment and recognizes experience outside of the formal workplace as important qualifications. We value the unique contributions that individuals from traditionally underrepresented and oppressed communities bring to our organization and encourage these individuals to apply.
The Prison Radio Show is a twice-monthly news show on CKUT. The show seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggles by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging ideas about what prisons are and who ends up inside. We are dedicated to programming that is directly collaborative with people who are currently incarcerated. With that in mind, we would like to let you know that we have a phone line for prisoners and their outside supporters. In fact, we have two phone lines. You can call us Collect from Bordeaux Prison and Riviere de Prairie Prison by calling 514-876-3748. We also have a number for non-collect calls. That number is 438-337-8423. Feel free to call that number and leave a message for us with news to share on the show or an audio message for your loved ones inside.
Ready? I'm Naomi Klein, author of The Shock Doctrine. You're listening to CKUT. Keep listening.
CKUT is looking for a full-time sales and administrative coordinator. The sales and administrative coordinator is responsible for the sale of on-air advertisements and co-presentation partnerships, as well as the negotiating of the radio station's administrative contractual agreements. The ideal candidate will have a passion for community radio, the ability to work with volunteers, clients, and community members, is well-organized, and has strong negotiating skills. We are looking for someone with knowledge of Montreal's arts, culture, and activity scenes who sees media as a tool for building community and can work in a non-hierarchical organization. Financial literacy, bilingualism, and experience with Google Suite products are also a requirement. For full details about the position, wage, and benefits, please visit ckut.ca. The cutoff for applications is Monday, February 6th at 5 p.m. CKUT strives to be a progressive working environment and recognizes experience outside of the formal workplace as important qualifications. We value the unique contributions that individuals from traditionally underrepresented and oppressed communities bring to our organization and encourage these individuals to apply.